Hi, everybody. Today's pre-accident podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Worker Health and Safety. Now, they've got a new 11-module program, and the entire reason they're sponsoring the podcast is to introduce you to these modules.
So the first title we're going to release is more informational for organizations, and it's really designed to help educate the entire population related to the new view of safety. So we get into looking at how the best-in-class organizations are utilizing these techniques to drive improvement, but ultimately set up the rest of the content that will be coming online at the end of the first quarter. This first module will be available for free, and we'll announce soon when you're able to access that content as well as where. Thank you.
All this at ulworkplace.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast.
Sure, but our brains are not wired for that.
Everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host. I'm Todd Conklin, and you're on the podcast. Hello, podcastarians, podcasters, podcast listeners, whatever you choose to be called, I choose to call you that. That's how well this works. So today's podcast, we're going to unwrap the mysteries of the universe like we try to do so many other times, all the time. That's kind of always our goal. And in this case, the universe we're going to try to unwrap is the elusive safety culture word. I don't know how I feel about safety culture. I mean, I have a background in this area. I'm fixated by culture at every level. I think it's really interesting. And I'm a big fan of Edgar Schein. And if you've not read Schein, you probably should. But I've got a treat for you today. Today we're going to talk to Nicole Barrett. Now, Nicole actually works with an organization at I2I, just an I-T-O-I.com. And she is she's an organizational psych person who's really focused on and looked at in great detail this notion of safety culture. And I really thought this was a great podcast. In fact, I will tell you, as far as cultural interventions go, this podcast will change the way you think about safety culture. And that's a pretty bold statement to make. And that, I think, is worth its time and weight in sort of how things are going. It's interesting. Work is just amazing. And my life's grand. I mean, that's good. That part's great. Everything's going well. I hope it is for you as well. Traveling, doing the stuff, talking to people, yammering. I'm just stunned, absolutely stunned by the podcast and how many people listen to it and the community that it's creating. I mean, if I don't thank you enough, I should. Thank you for listening and sticking through the good ones and the bad ones and the easy ones and the not so easy ones. It's amazing to me how much this little goofy new media activity has impact on how we do our work and what's going on. And for you, I should say thank you, because listening and the comments and the feedback you give, it's all pretty remarkable. And that's good. And that's good. And part of the reason we do it is because of today's podcast. You'll see when we get into the discussion we're going to have today just how incredibly interesting what you do for a living, whether you're in DevOps or a pilot or a doctor or a safety guy. It's a pretty amazing thing, and we'll talk about it. Listen for these words today, because this sort of changed the way I thought about this podcast. Look for, seek, and create diabolical change. That, my friends, is what you do for a living. Put it on your resume. What's your skill set, Mr. Conklin? Well, I create diabolical change. Do you need me? That, my friends, that is worth its weight in gold. So listen carefully to this podcast. This is Nicole Barrett, and we're going to talk a little bit about safety culture.
Okay, well, I live in Australia. I'm quite well traveled. I've never been to the US, but certainly seen and spent a lot of time in Europe and Asia. I think my early travels for nearly 3 years throughout Europe in my early 20s really sparked up an interest in anthropology, and I was quite fascinated by people and how I was under this delusion that young people over there would be just like me, you know, that so I was quite taken and surprised by the different cultures and how, you know, driving in a car for a couple of hours and you were in a different environment with different music and language and money and sense of timing, I guess. So when I came back from traveling, I was interested in anthropology and linguistics and did a bit of homework and realized there probably wasn't much of a future for that in Australia anyway, unless you were an academic. So I got into psychology and then, you know, the study of human behavior and, you know, why we do particular things. And then as I progressed throughout my academic education, I discovered the concept of organizational psychology, which was more about how groups behave, which was sort of meeting that need around or interest around anthropology. So I started to specialize in organizational culture.
And what led you into looking at safety culture?
That sort of started early, actually. I was lucky enough to sit next to a general manager of Energex at a luncheon. And we sort of had this frank and fearless, if not little bit of a cheeky conversation together. And he took a risk and got me to come in and have a look at their safety culture in a part of their business. So that was probably the first step. That would have been about 12 or 13 years ago. And then it kind of kept popping up throughout my career when I was working in a project environment on infrastructure projects, looking at improving safety performance. It came up a lot with coaching clients. I had a couple of clients that had been in senior positions during when there'd been a fatality. So I could see, you know, I started to get quite emotionally connected to the importance of safety as well. And then more recently, sort of the last 3 years, working with Contact Energy and Origin Energy, I mean, safety is a really that's their priority. So it's that was kind of a key aspect of my role.
What have you learned about safety? How would you define safety culture? I think it's kind of amorphous. It always worries me that I think people use safety culture as kind of an elaborate way to blame the worker. But what do you think safety culture is?
Well, it's a really good question, and I can give you the textbook answer, but I think it's more helpful to recognize, firstly, that safety culture is not an empirical entity. What we're really talking about is culture more broadly, and how that relates to and interacts with safety behaviors in the workplace.
So define culture for us then, because that's an excellent starting place.
Okay. So I think, you know, by way of example, we experience and observe behaviors and decisions on a daily basis in the workplace. So from a safety perspective, we're observing, you know, how the leaders spend their time, how they communicate about safety, how the organization invests or where, you know, where it's spending its money. We observe who's getting promoted and why that's happened and who's getting punished, and all those kinds of symbols inform people about what's important. And so then they start to make assumptions around what do I need to do to be successful in this organization or be successful in that, in my role, because they'll look up and make assumptions about the kinds of behaviors that are going to be rewarded. So it's kind of this complex learning process that it's shifting and changing, you know, all the time, I believe. It's not something that's static.
Is culture something that can be managed then?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you don't understand your culture, it will manage you without doubt. But it's certainly something that, you know, we can influence, you know, from a top down and a bottom up. Even I think sometimes the workforce can be quite influential, but you know, ultimately we do look for symbols that come from, you know, leaders and managers.
And so the leader and manager behavior becomes pretty paramount to sort of being the cultural thermostat, maybe? And what metaphor am I looking for?
I think it really sets the tone. It sets the scene about, you know, what's important.
So leadership behavior matters. What they do matters to the culture that the organization has.
Yeah, they're constantly being assessed. And the smallest deviation, like in particularly in safety culture, it's really interesting how, you know, a leader could be an awesome leader and really, really supportive of safety and invest huge amounts of time and money But the smallest little deviation and people will be going, aha, see, safety is not important. So they're constantly on the lookout for singles that might contradict whether it's a priority or whether they need to, you know, prioritize something else in terms of their behavior.
So when you work with leaders around this notion of culture and safety and all the things we're talking about, what do you tell them? I mean, how do you help them?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, most leaders and managers now know that culture is important, but it's messy. It's complex. It's intangible. So they're not always comfortable with it, I guess. And if I think about my own self and, you know, what does the word safety culture do to me? I can go to a place where that creates quite a bit of anxiety. If I think that I'm not really equipped to manage that, do I have the skills to create the right kind of culture? Or I can go to a place where it's really exciting and I'm in a position to influence and have a really positive impact and keep people safe. So I think for leaders, it potentially can trigger that fear state if they don't feel equipped to manage their safety. So working through that is a first step, I guess, in really understanding how they contribute, which can be quite confronting for them at times because usually they have the best of intentions.
Oh, totally. Totally. I can see that. Well, so what do you help them? I mean, walk me through that. What do you tell a leader who's just now discovering that the culture they have in the organization is probably not the culture that's going to get them to the next level? How do you start that?
Yeah. Well, look, a lot of the work I've done more recently has been culture research. And so we're starting from a really solid baseline. The data is the data. It's thematic, it's consistent. And so we present that back to them and we have conversations around, does that ring true? So, you're testing whether my findings are valid. And usually they can come up with stories and examples that confirm those hypotheses that have been presented. So we then reflect on, how are you contributing? And, that's a awesome process when you see the lights come on and you go, oh, yeah, okay, now I get it. And then you really start to think about, well, what are you worried about? What do we need to change? And I'm not an advocate of large scale change programs. I think it can be, particularly around culture, it can be overwhelming for leaders. And if you're doing too many things, it gets lost. Whereas if you just do one or two things differently and you're really visible about that and you make clear links to the workforce around, well, you told us this and now we're doing that. And it's easy for them to see that the change is happening. So doing little things, little experiments is quite helpful. And then constantly measuring and checking in and engaging with people is, how are we going?
How do you measure culture like that? Because I'm really sensitized to this because I have a pretty similar background to you. And I'm really worried that we have, like I'm not a big fan of surveys. I think there's huge survey fatigue.
Look, I'm not either, and I don't know if you've read that there's some research called the impossibility of safety culture assessment. I think some businesses are relying on surveys alone, and they absolutely can be misleading. And there was some research done after there was an incident in the Snorre Alpha. I think it was an uncontrolled gas blowout below the seabed, and fortunately nobody was injured, but it could have been disastrous. And post accident they did some research and they had three different sources of data, and this organization actually had done a culture survey about 6 months before the incident, and they came up as generative, like it was all positive. So those leaders would have been, everyone would have been patting themselves on the back thinking this is awesome. And then 6 months later, they had this incident, and the deep dive assessments really uncovered that there was issues with their culture, but the survey didn't detect that. So, you do need to triangulate in doing your assessment. There's a whole bunch of reasons why surveys can be a bit misleading. We can hypothesize about those, but the important thing is it's a valuable tool in terms of you can reach a wide audience, you can compare groups, and you do get a hard baseline or a number. But interview and focus group data really gives you that richness. You really get clearer insights about what does that number mean? Why have people scored you in that particular way? And you hear the cultural stories and the assumptions that people make and the behaviors that they're taking. So you've kind of got to have a really rigorous approach to understanding your culture.
How long does that take? I mean, is that a long process?
Well, you know, qualitative analysis is it's a hard going process. You know, we record or we type verbatim what people are saying, and then you kind of code that, you know, develop a coding schema, and every time a particular person says a particular theme, that gets coded. So you're kind of turning the qualitative into quantitative, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Can leaders do that at a lower level, at a more ongoing level, by sort of putting together, I don't know, brown bag lunches? I mean, are there ways leaders can sort of pulse culture?
Sure, you can do, and that's, you know, I mean, that's the way. Ideally, you get a really good solid benchmark, and you really understand your culture, and then the pulse check is absolutely. It's much better if it's leaders out there talking about. Well, you know, you told us that, you know, you've told us a particular thing and this is what we've been doing. And are you feeling that impact? You know, are you noticing anything different? Checking in with them, you know, site visits and really getting down to walking around the office or going out into the field and engaging with people and having authentic conversations. They're really keen to tell what the problems are. They don't hold back.
Oh, absolutely. And I think they're experts at it, right? I mean, they're expert at where the pain points are in the organization. They're experts where the processes are especially crappy and where the processes are especially good. Why don't you think leaders know this? I mean, I guess the mystery to me is how can leadership be so disconnected from an organization that they're leading?
That's a tricky question. You know, I think it's not just one thing, is it? There is, again, there's that anxiety. So if a leader may not necessarily have come up through the frontline ranks, so, you know, there might be some trepidation about how do I actually engage with these people wearing, you know, orange or yellow shirts and hard hats. Like it's not, they're not familiar with that territory. So, you know, that in itself can be anxiety provoking, that they're used to having boardroom conversations or talking to professional people. And so there might be a fear of them being judged as not having any credibility in the area of operations or safety. I mean, that's one thing to consider that makes it difficult for them. You know, they might not like what they're going to hear. It means... you know, it increases accountability in terms of how the office or, you know, corporate people are contributing to the frontline environment. There's a couple of things that come to mind that make it hard.
Oh, yeah. Those are, I mean, how important is it to have like an objective person, a person like you to come in and sort of help guide that process? Because it seems like just talking to you for the short time we've been talking, there's a pretty huge advantage to bringing in somebody who's maybe not an expert in the company's culture, but an expert in identifying and helping understand the company's culture.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think it's critical because you don't really, you know, you see a lot of investment in safety, for example. Companies spend, you know, enormous amounts of money on trying to do the right thing. A lot of that can be wasted if you're actually trying to fix a problem that you don't really understand. So I think, as I said, getting that good baseline and a clear understanding of what is really going on here is critical, and it's an objective view. So I once had a CEO say to me, I can't believe they tell you this stuff. And I made a joke and said, you know, pretty woman sitting in front of these guys, they can't wait to tell you the story. But but they, you know, being a psychologist, I think helps. They feel safe that they remain anonymous. So you get a clear picture for the leader. It's critical. You know, for me, it's important rather than investing all this time and money with an off-target solution. It helps them really understand how am I contributing to this? You know, what is it that this leadership team or even, you know, it's not just the the leaders at the top, you know, and they make decisions about where money gets invested and resources and things like that. But then you've got the different layers of management, and depending on how big the organization is and how hierarchical it is, frontline supervisors also have an immediate impact. I mean, if that's the person that's going to be assessing my performance and deciding on whether I'm going to get a bonus, for example, then I'm going to do what they say, even if the senior leaders are clearly talking about safety being a priority. If they told me to run out and fix something and we haven't, you know, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's, then 9 times out of 10, the person will still go and do it. So we've got to look at every level of the organization. Anybody that's in a position of influence or power, for want of a better word, has a strong impact on the way people will behave.
And then what do you do? So you do this, look, you look around, you identify all these great things, you create this data set, and then what do you do?
Yeah, well, then you've got to give the work back to the business. I mean, they've got to lead it. There's got to be commitment, absolute commitment from the top. And, you know, you have a top-down, bottom-up approach. The answers don't sit with one person. You know, I'm a researcher. I'm not an expert that has all the answers about safety culture, but you get the right people in the room and we can do some amazing things. We can come up with, you know, with real collaboration when we're scratching our head going, God, you know, how do we approach this problem? And you get the various and diversity of views with good representation from frontline, from engineers, from safety professionals, from behavioral experts. And then you have some senior people in there that are championing and representing the importance of it. Then I think you start to get some really good ideas happening and commitment about change.
And when you do this work and you see these companies sort of identify areas of opportunity and then actually simultaneously identify small micro experiments they can do to actually impact those areas of opportunities. What's it feel like? I mean, what's going on? What do you look for? What changes in the company?
I think you start to see a lot of change, not just around safety. You know, one organization I'm thinking of in particular that is an awesome case study on what to do. From what I hear, they are seeing, you know, they're seeing improved engagement. They're seeing improvement in efficiencies more broadly, not just in safety. So I think, you know, they say a safe organization is a profitable one. If you're good at safety, then you're likely to be efficient and good at other operational practices.
Well, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's the idea that when you're really excellent at operations, then you're excellent at operations. It's funny to me that safety is divided out in the boardroom, but to the guys on the platform, there is no difference between safety and production. I mean, it's all work to them, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you said something earlier that made me think about, you know, we have to be careful that we don't blame the worker because they're at the pointy end. You know, they're the ones that are going to be hurt. So, again, if we think about, you know, the purpose of the brain is to perpetuate the species. I mean, they're inherently motivated to be safe. So we've got to be really mindful of that, whereas the leaders can step in and out of it. They've got other priorities as well. But for the person at the front line, one small mistake and can be a disaster. So
this may be one of the best safety culture discussions I've ever had. I'm super impressed with what you're talking about. What are you thinking next? I mean, what are you reading? What's interesting you? Kind of what's keeping you moving forward?
What's keeping me moving forward? I think the need for some diabolical change in a couple of areas that really interest me. One is the, you know, the complexity of systems. Like we are tying these guys up in knots with paperwork. Firstly, it's not their gig. It's not what they want to do. You know, they're people that want to work with their hands. They want to work outside. They don't want to be in there in front of a computer or filling in paperwork, it makes it very difficult for them to think about the risks if they're constantly looking behind, geez, did I tick that box? You know, so there's a lot of lost productivity and growing increased tick and flick mentality. And that worries me because I think they will look for ways to get around that in order to get the job done. That's what they're there to do. That's what they're being paid for. In their minds. So that's something I'm quite passionate about. The other one around, you know, I've been hearing this, oh, you know, people will always take risks, and particularly in the Australian culture. I'm not sure about the US, but we've got a bit of a reputation for being risk takers. And I think we need to be really cautious about that human kind of nature language, because for one, it might unconsciously be abdicating in any responsibility in the manager's mind. You know, well, if it's human nature to take risks, then what can I do about it? So I think we need to be cautious about that. But the other thing is that there's a really strong correlation between the workforce's perceptions about whether management's committed to safety and the level of risk-taking behavior. So we know there's a link there. We've got to recognize that people will be motivated to behave based on the assumptions they come to about, you know, the organization's goals. So if people are taking risks, you have to ask yourself why. Why are they taking the risk? It's not always human nature. I think we need to be really cautious about that. That worries me.
Oh, no, I think what you're saying is amazing, that when you see high levels of risk-taking or perceived risk-taking, you can pretty much just assume that the worker's in the presence of some powerful organizational forces. Fair enough?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so they're the things. They're two things. Whether people speak up or not speak up, that really interests me. You know, a lot of organizations espouse and encourage people. Yes, you can stop the job, you can intervene, but that's really hard to do. Like, I once had this girl tell me that she was in a vehicle and she was a young engineer and she was in a vehicle with a supervisor and they were traveling from one place to another and it was raining and he kind of just kept driving towards this flooded road, which was absolutely against policy to cross it. And she was quite scared, you know, but she didn't speak up. She didn't say anything. We're dealing with systemic issues around, you know, where do I sit in the hierarchy, gender, age, all those sorts of things play into whether a person will speak up and intervene if they see something unsafe too. So that's quite fascinating, that dynamic.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I'm fixated on sort of how easy it is to determine when a worker should have called stop work retrospectively. Are you available? Can people call you and talk to you? Because I know there's going to be people that want to call you and talk to you.
Yeah. Well, we've got a good team. We have a small team. So, but we're very passionate about what we do. We've been doing it a long time. It's a diverse workforce. Some people have come from risk and safety assurance or investigation backgrounds. And some of the people I work with have come from very much, you know, the behavioral sciences. So yeah, it's exciting. We love what we do.
How do we contact you?
Well, I've got a website. My company's called Insight to Influence, which is all about once you have that insight, then you're empowered and have some level of control about what you do with that information. So it informs your decision making and action. We have a website, which is I2I, which is Itoi. So small I-T-O-I. Itoi was a Japanese philosopher, apparently.
Very cool. That's kind of a unexpected benefit there. That's nice. I2I.com, yeah? I2I.com?
.com.au, yeah. And the usual LinkedIn, Facebook, we've got pages. I'm just learning about this social media. It's a new thing for me.
Well, and look, you get to be on a podcast. How about that?
That's why I was nervous.
No, you just shouldn't be nervous. You did amazing. That was an incredibly good job. Terminado, fine, kaput, complete, done, finished. What do you think? Holy guacamole. You want to pick a more complex topic? Let's try. Oh, I can't think of one. Safety culture discussion, as good as I've heard in a long time. Actually, I thought Nicole really has it together. I like the way she thinks about culture in a complex, adaptive way. I have to tell you, as a cultural intervention, I think this is pretty good. I mean, there's some themes that came up. One, culture exists. Two is that managers oftentimes don't know how or suffer great anxiety around leading cultural issues. Boy, that's fair and a really good statement. Three is that risk is influenced by culture. Risk-taking behaviors influenced by culture. And that a culture that accepts risk will drive risk, which is exactly what Mary Douglas says. It's what John Adams says. They're all talking about it that way. Culture is really, really complicated and yet vital. And it's too complex to talk about simply. And so we have to learn to talk about it. That was Nicole Barrett, i2i.com.au. Thanks for being here. You're a huge part of this podcast. As always, learn something new every single day. You can check that one off today. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.
But it's messy. It's complex. It's intangible. It's